Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Greetings. You are listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. I have that like written out where I have initials and stuff. So I have to go through my head. Okay, am I saying this right? Because I don't want to mix them up. So anyway, I'm doing something a little different today. So I've asked on my LCI colleague and biblical anarchy podcast host, Jacob Winograd, to discuss an article that I was sure would irritate both of us to no end. And the reason I asked him on is actually, I think it's actually an article that's worth considering and engaging with. It's called Is MAGA Christianity True Christianity? And it was written by Michael Renaud and Paul D. Miller, and it was published by The Dispatch. I did reach out to the authors, incidentally, to see if they'd like to discuss it, but as of recording time, I've not heard back from them. Wanted to do like a pro wrestling thing. I was like, come talk to me in the ring and we'll settle this thing. But no. So the reason I thought the piece would irritate both Jacob and me, Yes, is because the basic thesis of the piece that they wrote is that old guard conservatism are the heirs of the Protestant Reformation, the Lutherans, the Reformed, that kind of, you know, Reformed sphere, and that MAGA are like this kind of modern instantiation of the Radical Reformation, like the Anabaptists, those folks. And so Jacob is Protestant and I'm Anabaptist, but as libertarians, neither one of us likes being compared to either like George W. Bush or Donald Trump. And so I was like, this is going to annoy both of us. We'll have to get his reaction to see if it annoyed him as much as I thought it did. So it is an interesting thought experiment, and it invites us to consider what are the core convictions of our faith tradition? What does it mean to be Protestant? What does it mean to be Anabaptist? And are there sort of, you know, trend lines, parallels that are kind of running through in modern politics, especially when you approach it from a Christian perspective? So I invited Jacob on so we could kind of look at this thing from two different angles. So Jacob, thank you for being here.
Yeah, of course. I appreciate it. When the headline alone was definitely like, you know, trigger worthy. I don't know that you sufficiently gave us a trigger warning when you shared it, but it was an interesting article. There's points of it I agree. I think there's like interesting stuff in there that I agree with the thrust of what he's getting at, even though I obviously have some sort of, because of our political inclinations, yeah, there's some parts in, where you kind of have to look at the heart of what he's saying and not get too tripped up by the sort of like political trigger language and comparisons he's using that I think are somewhat unhelpful.
Well, yeah, and also to give, you know, some credit or leeway here, maybe every parallel breaks down at a certain point, right? And so I think sometimes these parallels can be instructive because they point out something that maybe we didn't notice in a certain line of thought. And so the question is, did they actually see something that was really interesting and valuable that maybe we hadn't noticed before? And so that's, I guess, what we'll get into. So we'll start with this. The piece begins by quoting that famous statement from Jesus, "Not everyone who says, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven." And the authors are modernizing this concern to argue that we can't use politics as an excuse to deny Jesus. And so if you know, hate your enemies, as Trump claimed to do, and as many evangelicals seem to cheer him on for saying, are you perhaps not really a Christian at all, but part of a false cult? That's kind of the question here. And so, I mean, I like to be ecumenical, and I hope that heaven will be as, you know, as full as possible. But I think the question is one that's worth considering here. With humility and fear, of course, lest we judge others by a standard that could be used against us. But I do agree with that statement that Jesus commands us, this is a quote, Jesus commands us to carefully discern who is and who is not truly among his followers. But, and I guess here's my question, do you think that there are political tests for salvation, or if not salvation, at least maybe for consistency with a claim to being a disciple of Jesus? So for example, the article notes, you know, Charlie Kirk said you can't be a Christian and vote Democrat, you know, primarily because of abortion. So like, would you agree with that statement? And would you also apply that to voting Republican because of, you know, war state stuff or or how does Trump go into that equation? Do you draw the line in any particular place when it comes to de-Christianizing people for political opinions?
Yeah, I think that it's funny. This is a little before you joined LCI. This was, by the way, I hope, just before I even answer this, I hope my voice isn't too bad. I just had like a over week long fight with some kind of flu, cold, COVID. I don't know anymore. When I get sick, I don't even bother getting tested. But so my voice might sound rough, or maybe it sounds better now. I don't know. A little bit of raspiness to it. Anyway, to your question, there is an old debate that happened back in Freedom Fest 2023. When we were doing a session on Christian nationalism, and we got into, and we still get, we'll touch base on this debate, you know, intra debate LCI once in a while, when we're getting into sort of like, is it faith or faithfulness that saves, and the debate over lordship salvation, and the degree to which allegiance is a component of the gospel. Okay, you know, obviously the kingdom of God and Christ as king is a core component of the gospel. But there's this tension that I really struggle with between not wanting to sort of say you're not a real Christian and your faith in Christ as your savior isn't genuine if your political beliefs are wrong, right? Like, I think that's clearly not true. But I do think that there are, or at least should be, I think there, if you're doing Christianity correctly, and if you are considering the lordship of Christ in the proper lens and holistically and not compartmentalizing that, there are political consequences to Christianity and to the gospel message. Does that necessarily mean that the political consequence is libertarianism, as we would articulate it? I mean, I want to be somewhat humble and ecumenical, and I guess I view it that there are negotiables and non-negotiables. And it seems like one problem I see here that this article is kind of touching at is that we here in the West have done a very bad job at sort of doing Christian political theorizing and discussions to kind of hash those out. And so people either think that there are no non-negotiables, and so they just kind of ad hoc add in any sort of like, you know, insert what this political party or this political pundit says, and they just, you know, mix that with their Christianity, or they compartmentalize in a sort of radical two kingdoms way that I think we would both disagree with. But there's obviously then people who then try to merge those things in ways that aren't helpful, or that are even, I think, just ill-founded, like they're overstating the case. Even some Christian anarchists, people who I generally like and agree with, but who I think go too far in sort of conflating the gospel and libertarianism. So it's there, as Jordan Peterson says, there's snakes everywhere with this question.
Well, and, you know, I wonder if there would be something helpful here in terms of thinking about kind of primary, secondary, tertiary kinds of theological commitments that, you know, not everything is a primary, you know, item of Christian belief or something that requires us to assent to in order to be Orthodox or something. But it does seem that there are certain political views that like should be beyond the pale, like you would hope.
You know, and yes, I agree. And you can think about this in the macro or the micro, right? Because I remember having this discussion with someone at my church. Actually, I've had this discussion with several people at my church. And it's just kind of doing the core libertarian critique, where it's just like, you know, well, if you're going to advocate for this law, would you use a gun yourself to, you know, coerce me or to initiate violence against me if I was doing this thing you think we need a law for, like, right? And so there's that very micro sense of like, you know, if you're calling for drug prohibition, it's like, okay, like if I'm using cannabis for some reason, maybe I'm saying it's medicinal, but I don't have the state's approval, right? You know, I didn't get the proper paperwork filled out or whatever. Or even if I am using it just to get high or something, which might be sinful, but like, are you going to, you know, come at the point of the gun and lock me in a cage over it? Like, is that the Christian response? And I think there's a lot of utility to that. Although I try to be, you know, humble and ecumenical in how I deploy that. But then obviously then on a more macro scale, then like, yeah, I think that there should hopefully be clear examples of, like, if your Christian political theology or lack thereof leads you to, like, fascism or communism or just, I guess it's like the two kind of extremes of the spectrum, or horseshoe theory, as it were, or some other, like, you know, catastrophic thing, you know, political philosophy, then you should check your premises, right? You probably did something wrong in your sort of calculations or integrations.
If you're justifying a Holocaust, then there's something there's something
I think, I mean, again, this is tough because I don't want to. It's hard to say this and not sound like you're just being a sort of, like, committed libertarian. But I do think, like, the best Christian way to say this is that if at any point you are saying that to be a good Christian means, like, inflicting violence upon your neighbor when your neighbor is acting peacefully, I don't know that you're loving your neighbor. You know what I mean? Like, and I know you and I have done, like, the pacifism debate, and you go as far as to say that you don't think it's loving your neighbor, even if you use force beyond a certain point defensively to your enemy, right? But we would, you know, that's a whole separate category. When someone's acting peacefully, right, they're not initiating force against anyone, and then you're going to tell me the Christ-like thing to do, the loving your neighbor thing to do, is to use force and violence against them. And that's what, you know, at the very least, you know, communism and Nazism, fascism, like, you know, those were ideologies that led to, like, intentional mass slaughter of hundreds of thousands and millions of people. So it's kind of like, I don't like it almost, it seems silly. And I guess there's not a lot of, well, I guess there are. I guess there's some people on the left who consider themselves Christians and they say Jesus was a socialist or Jesus was a communist. And then there's people on the right, you know, and these often will call themselves Christian nationalists now, who say that, you know, they're like, we're Christians and we believe what the Protestant fathers said, and they said fascism's cool. So,
well, yeah, well, the issue is, and this doesn't go for anything that people on the Christian left or right say, but in a lot of cases, they're picking up on something that Jesus actually said or supported in some way. The difference was he didn't say this needs to be supported through violence, right? Like, Jesus may have promoted a conservative sexual ethic, but he didn't say let's stone gay people or whatever, right? So, like, that's right. That's the distinction that gets missed.
Well, and it feels like I've been asking this question for almost 2 years now, and I've not got a answer from the Christian right that is in the more populist and nationalist camp, which is just like, what is your line? What's your standard for what distinguishes between sinful behavior and criminal behavior? Obviously, all criminal behavior is going to be sinful behavior, but clearly not all sinful behavior can be criminalized. So, like, you need a standard. And, you know, it should be a standard beyond just, like, you know, your whims and whatever feels right and just making it up as you go.
Sorry about that. I was trying to unmute, but my touchpad was not really responding. So, yeah, a lot to think about there. We'll maybe move past that for just for time reasons. But I think that there's a much bigger conversation to have about this sort of question regarding the entailments of Christian ethics in politics. But there's, I think, maybe the key idea in the article is here, and I'll quote this: "Where does MAGA Christianity come from? The landscape of American Christianity today lies downstream of the Reformation era split between the Magisterial Reformation, High Church, and the Radical Reformation, Low Church. The Magisterial Reformation was elite, top-down, intellectual, and close to state power. The Radical Reformation was populist, bottom-up, emotional, and disempowered," end quote. And so I've got my own thoughts on this, but maybe I'll ask you your thoughts first, which is, so, you know, leaving aside this relationship between MAGA and Anabaptism for now, and we get back into that. Do you agree with the framing that the Magisterial Reformation, the Reformation of Luther and Calvin and Zwingli, was basically an elite and statist kind of Reformation, whereas the Radical Reformation was more populist and disempowered? Are those, like, the key differences when you kind of look back in church history and you say, what's the difference between these two streams? Is it elite and statist versus populist and disempowered?
I mean, not to be cliche, but as you know, my favorite three-word answer is compared to what? And I just think that it's like, yeah, there's elements of Luther and Calvin that are pro-state, but there's obviously elements of them and the Protestant Reformation that was pushing for, you know, sort of less of a sort of like church-state combination than what they were reacting to and reforming away from. So I think it's a little bit complicated there. But like, if I was going to be charitable, then I'd say that, like, in a very generic sense, that that's, you know, kind of true. I mean, certainly, and this is stuff that you've obviously, you know, written about in your books that came out last year. That yeah, there was a the Radical Reformation was much more. It's fair to say that they were much more skeptical of state power, and partly why they were against infant baptism was because of that. Than the Magisterial Reformation, but yeah, so I think there's something to that. I think there's something to that even just beyond just that point in history. And there's just at any point in Christianity, and even today, I think there's just this tension between those who are sort of like pro sort of normative authority of the church and of institutions. Because certainly Luther and Calvin and Zwingli, they were not like non-denominational Protestant evangelicals, right? Like they were still like, they might have been like less high church than Rome, but they were still you know, pretty high church in terms of the spectrum of a Christian thought. They still thought the church played a high role, even if it wasn't an infallible authority. But again, that's why I said it's always compared to what, because like, you compare Calvin to, you know, Catholicism, then he seems like he's more low church, but I'm lower church than Calvin, but I'm higher church than some other Baptist. So it's, you know, I hate to say it's all relative, because I don't think it's all relative. And there's a lot more I could say to that. But yeah, I think there's, just to your basic question, there's part of that I think is oversimplified, but there's, you know, there's like a meme there that is true.
Yeah. I've thought about this a lot, and, you know, I don't think that the simplest way to sum up the difference between the Magisterial and the Radical Reformation is high church versus low church, for example. Nor is it necessarily institutional versus deinstitutional or anti-institutional. I think the real difference is that the Magisterial Reformation, we say compared to what? I guess I'd say compared to each other. That the Magisterial Reformation supported a state church, and we're, you know, okay with, you know, some violence that we might go along with that. And the Radical Reformation sort of felt that, okay, well, you know, we're going back to the Sermon on the Mount. We're going back to the early church rejection of things like war and state violence. And so, and I think I'd also say that the Radical Reformation wasn't simply disempowered. I think this is something you hear about the early church a lot too. Like people say, well, the early church, they were nonviolent because they didn't have any other option. It wasn't because they had a conviction about being nonviolent. And I think that's something very, you know, I think they're doing something similar at the Anabaptists and the Radical Reformation here. The Anabaptists weren't just disempowered, they rejected state power, right? And there's some examples of you know, kind of wayward Anabaptists moving, you know, being much more comfortable with state power. But then others said, no, absolutely not. That's not for us, right? And so, you know, that primary Radical Reformation group that we talk about is the Anabaptists, and they divided with Zwingli because he wanted to let the city of Zurich determine theology and practice. And they were suspicious of top-down power, and I'll concede that there was an element maybe of populism and anti-intellectualism there, but I'd also say with some footnotes. Like there's really, I think, also an element of populism in the Magisterial Reformation compared to Catholicism.
Right.
Because Catholicism is all about elites versus the regular people. And Protestantism sort of said, no, actually, the work of a cobbler is holy, right? And so the idea that you could be a holy person, you could be a priest unto God without actually being like an elite or being part of that sort of, you know, institutional mechanism of the church was, I think, really a populist insight, right? And I think, you know, certainly with the Anabaptists, you know, when you're being systematically murdered, you don't have access to universities, right? So you value obedience and faithfulness over positions at the seats of learning. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they were against institutions, because they built churches, and they had sort of church networks, and so those are institutions. And there were also, you know, some I think brilliant, highly literate Anabaptist leaders. Some of them because they had been educated as Catholic priests, and then had a conversion to Anabaptism. But I think sometimes that emphasis on faithfulness over privilege could become populist, and you do see that in Anabaptism in the 16th century. But I think there's also, you know, kind of cosmopolitanism, because they're rejecting nationalism, they're rejecting state power. They're moving across state borders. They're quoting Psalm 22, the earth is the Lord's. And so there's this very kind of international idea there that state borders are ultimately not real, right? And that's not a super populist idea. So yeah, and also I guess I'll say this too. If we're talking about the Radical Reformation and not just the Anabaptists, you do have highly rationalistic and intellectual movements within the Radical Reformation, like the Unitarians and the Socinians. Those are, you know, not, you know, anti-intellectual groups, but by any means, right? They're super rationalistic. And so, yeah, I mean, I think there is a distinction. I think the primary one is about violence, but there's also, I think, kind of a bottom-up versus top-down approach. I think Luther, for example, really thought that good theology needed to be preached at the top and forced, so to speak, on those down below to kind of keep everybody in line. And that's just not really the way the Anabaptists saw it.
Yeah. No, there's this, like when I was rereading it again today, like I was, you know, this just gets back into, again, all the, in, you know, cross denomination talk, and the, where do you fall on the spectrum of high, medium, low church or whatever. And then like, obviously then, like, I'm always thinking that this is a libertarian, but there's obviously people who then, like, if they're low church, they might tend towards, lower state, but not necessarily. And if they're higher church, they might lean towards more state, but again, not necessarily. But I feel like in terms of authority and the role it has, I feel like the difference between not just maybe the radical reformers and magisterial ones, but just in general, a trend I still see today, which I think maps on to the broader discussion about even just like the parallels of this within the church in like modern political discourse is sort of like, I guess, like more faith in institutions versus kind of not wanting to rely on like an expert class or elite class, and instead going with that more populist, like will of the people kind of thing.
I'm actually,
despite the fact that I am like I'm a Reformed Baptist, lowercase r Reformed, who attends a non-denominational church. So you'd think I'd be pretty low church, but I actually think that church authority is really important. But I think that the difference that I have is that I think that it's not that church authority is like supposed to be normatively binding in this like top-down way, but I think that church authority, and I'd also throw into that church tradition, and studying church history, that these are supposed to be like guardrails. And the analogy I think of is like bowling, and it's like putting the little bumpers up on the side of, you know, keeping you free. So it's like church authority and tradition, if we're using them correctly, they should be used to kind of like, you have a lot of flexibility to explore and look at things differently, but within these guardrails, right? They keep you from going completely into the gutter, into completely bad theology. And I feel like we're kind of stuck in our politics and in our theology, is at least where we live in the West, in this, I think broadly in the East too, in this sort of like false dichotomy between just like you either want the church to be like top-down control, or people tend to then think like, no, we don't want that, then people can just believe whatever they want. And there's no role for institutions to play a role. So again, I think there's a lot of mapping on between the theological and the political here, because as you know, like we've had these discussions a lot, that there's people who, because our institutions in a political and an economic and market sense have sort of been delegitimizing themselves lately, people have been kind of, instead of going, we need better elites and better and reforms in the institutions, they're like, we don't need experts or institutions at all. And, you know, it's like, well, I think we need institutions and experts. I just think, you know, the state is bad at providing those.
Well, and I think that that's, I mean, a big question that comes to my mind here is Trump really anti-institution or anti-power or anti-top-down power? And like the answer is like, well, obviously not. Like he's rejecting some institutions. Like he rejects the media unless it's, you know, deferent to him. He rejects academia unless it's deferent to him. He rejects, you know, FBI, CIA, the Justice Department, unless it's deferent to him.
It depends on if it's President Trump or nominee Trump. Right.
Yeah.
Like when Trump is running, he's against the institutions.
Yeah.
The FBI, you know, like
he's not in them.
Yeah. When he's not part of the power apparatus, he's very good at calling out the corruption of the power apparatus. Even, you know, going as far as to, you know, like after the assassination attempt and after all the January 6th stuff and all the legal stuff he went through, you know, and then he's running with people and they're like, we're going to gut the intelligence agencies. We're going to end all the wars. Right. And then you get in there and it's just like, actually, the FBI is cool now and it's the Department of War and we're bombing, you know, boats off the coast of Venezuela and potentially going, you know, like instead of ending the wars, how about we add a bonus South American war to the mix? It's like.
Actually, the Justice Department is great so long as a guy that wrote two children's books about me is running it.
Right.
Yeah. And so I think that this is part of the problem is I think there can be kind of an anti-institutional sentiment amongst, you know, the MAGA right, but it's not really, I mean, they're trying to put him in the office of president. And it's not like he's going in there and saying, you know, let's gut my power or, you know what I mean? He's not like malaying it even. And Malay's not totally consistent on that point, but he's not even going in that really that direction. And so there's, and I think this goes back to this, he used the language of guardrails, like theological guardrails. And that first question we had about, is there a sense in which there are places that you can't be as a Christian politically and be consistent. And it's like, if you're letting a politician or a political party set those guardrails for you rather than scripture or, you know, scripture plus tradition or whatever, however you want to do that, then yeah, you're going to have some serious problems because to be a Christian for some people means, do you support the president? And, you know, that's, you know, it's allegiance to the kingdom of God, you know, Christ and everything, not a politician.
Or so, it's allegiance to hating the other side.
Yeah, there you
go. It's you know, because there's plenty of people who are on the right, MAGA or not, who don't even like Trump that much, but they're just like, we got to vote, you know, red no matter what.
Right. So, and I think there is this thing, I don't think that the framing of low church and high church is actually really that helpful here for like a few reasons. I mean, so one thing is, I mean, does low church mean being anti-institution? And like you pointed out that there is like authority and even in a low church model. And you see that a lot amongst a lot of low church Christians, that they'll have the authority of the pastor. Oftentimes they're in a denomination. That denomination is viewed as having some authority. And that's not really different than you'd see like in an Anglican church or, you know, a church that's more high church, quote unquote. So a lot of times the distinction's made between, you know, the type of worship you use. So I don't know that low church, high church is even the right word to use here, but they do something else that's kind of weird by defining low church as radical reformation and high church as magisterial reformation. They're like, oh, well, the fundamentalist movement of the 20th century, the Azusa Street Revival and the birth of the Pentecostals, the Christian right, the moral majority, those are Anabaptist movements. Those are like, you know what I mean? They say radical reformation movements. And it's like the Christian right is a radical reformation Anabaptist movement. Pentecostals are an Anabaptist movement. And it's like, well, no, obviously not. But once they've kind of created this frame, you know, they kind of have to take what comes with it. And so they end up doing some really kind of bizarre things because, I mean, you know, one thing I've said before, and this is coming from my Anabaptist bias is, you know, church history after the Protestant Reformation is just basically Protestants slowly saying, okay, well, the Anabaptists were right about this one. And so, you know, whether it's, you know, okay, yeah, maybe we were wrong about infant baptism or maybe we were wrong. about, you know, church and state stuff. We need to go a little bit more in this direction. And so, you know, there's, you can see some of that, but it's not like the moral majority were, you know, Anabaptists or anything close to it. They're, you know, hearkening back to what they think of as that kind of Protestant Reformation, Magister Reformation tradition. And insofar as they're saying church and state need to be connected, they're far more magisterial than they are radical. And so, you know, so insofar as you have like the idea of a believer's church rather than a state church, you could maybe trace that back to the radical Reformation. So like the Stone Campbell movement, which is in many cases very right wing today, but it's part of that believer's church model. That's very radical. But it's kind of, even there, there's kind of the familial resemblance is more like a nephew than of a child. Like you can draw some connections, and some groups within that movement might look more Anabaptist than others. But so yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if some of these groups that we're talking about, like, I think I lost my train of thought here. I think really what Renaud and Miller are saying when they say radical Reformation is railing against elites in the establishment. They also sort of imply that the radical Reformation is cut off from tradition. And that's not really true either, unless you mean that they're rejecting the idea of the war state and its institutions. But I mean, the radical, so I mean, you know, when I did a book on Anabaptist systematic theology, and you go through their confessions in the 16th and 17th centuries, and they're largely built around the apostles and the Nicene creeds. And they take a side on the filioque because they're part of that Western tradition. And so they don't reject all of that, but they do reject part of it, right? They look at some of what had developed in the intervening centuries and said, this seems to be going in the wrong direction.
I largely agree with all that. I mean, I think, and I know you think the magisterial reformers didn't go far enough, but even they were trying to, like there's some Catholics and Orthodox who say the Protestant, even the magisterial ones, were just sort of like saying, screw church history and tradition. And I'm like, well, I mean, Calvin quotes, just like, I mean, and Luther, they're just constantly going back and citing church fathers and whatnot. And so, I don't think that's accurate at all. I feel like, I think there's a problem with that framing, maybe partly from like a, you know, historical ignorance, or at least just kind of like oversimplification. But I do get the point of like, I think the more fundamental thing is that kind of sort of like suspicion of elites, and there's like a conflation of suspicion of elites and suspicion of power. And I get the conflate. I think I often fall into this where there's a lot of people who are kind of adjacent to libertarians, or at least friendly with libertarians, but who are more in this MAGA or right wing populist, and they can sort of seem like, okay, like maybe you're not a anarcho-capitalist, right? You don't believe in the non-aggression principle. We're not quite in the same camp, but you're recognizing that there's a group of elites who are wielding power not for the American idea of like, you know, they're governing based on the consent of the governed and doing so to uphold liberty. No, they're doing it to enrich themselves and to empower themselves. And there are elements in MAGA, even today, who I think rightfully point that out. Although a lot of the good ones have kind of become ostracized by the movement now because they called Trump out on on the corruption and on the Epstein stuff and all that. But that is kind of the problem, right? It is kind of like you do need something that's, I guess, deeper than just the anti-elite. Because again, it's like I could go very right-wing libertarian on this, and like I don't think it'd be correct to read Mises or to read Roth. Well, Rothbard's more complicated on this, but if you read like Hoppe, even like, or you read someone like Ayn Rand, like, again, none of these people I'm saying are like perfectly encapsulating my thoughts on this, but they're just examples of libertarian thinkers who, even though they might rail against elites in some of their writings, they're not like anti-elitist in a general sense. Like they are kind of in favor of, like, they actually think that the problem with the state is that it creates bad elites because it's based on fiat and monopoly, whereas a free market, it enables the actual elites, the ones who are, you know, because instead of having hierarchies of power, you have a hierarchy of competence. And so the great men, you could, that's a Randian turn, the great men are going to rise up and sort of lead society, not through necessarily through force and coercion, but just through their ability to, like, innovate and create and all that. So,
And that is the key distinction, is it an institution that rules by fiat or rules through violence? Or is it an institution that is created voluntarily to meet the needs of people? And I think that is the distinction. I mean, that because that's the distinction, certainly, that Anabaptists were making. If you look at, Hutterite communities today that share all property and stuff like that, people are taken care of. You know, if you get old in a Hutterite community and you can't work anymore, someone will still look after you. But also there's, like, an expectation to work. And so you have all these, you know, ways in which that voluntary society does things like welfare or taking care of the community much better than involuntary society of the state. And so, you know, Anabaptists are not anti-institution, but in the same way, largely, that libertarians are not anti-institution. I think if you're going to be a good libertarian, you have to be pro-institutions. You just have to be anti-violent institutions, right?
Yeah, no, I think I agree with that. I think that it's easy in the current paradigm to get lost in that, at least especially in this moment, because the institutions are predominantly bad and corrupt. And then even when maybe they try to correct a little bit, they've lost the trust of people. And we're living in a moment where it's kind of complicated, because I would say the trust in institutions is kind of at an all-time low, but that's true for a large percentage of the people. But then conversely, a sizable minority, a large section of the population do trust in, maybe not the institutions in a generic sense, but they trust in one man, right? They trust in one party. So it's kind of the same. And so, like, it's kind of like the problem is like they're not consistent even with their anti-elitism, right? Like if you were just operating purely on anti-elitism, then as soon as you still should have turned coat on Trump as soon as he started ruling like an elite. But they're like, so it's like, well, you're not really anti-elitism. You were just anti when the left's in charge and when their elites are doing things that you don't like. And again, I think this whole problem stems, as far as it applies to Christians, and as far as this article was talking about the problem on the right, it's that we're stuck between those who are pro-institution on the right are not pro-institution on a principled standpoint. They're pro kind of like, they're basically saying, let's return to like the era of America between 1960 and like 1990, you know, maybe like Bush era conservatism. And like, that's none of that's good, right? And I think people, if I'm going to say something positive about like the MAGA movement, like they intrinsically know that's not good. Even like Christian nationalists just kind of know, yeah, like that's not good. Like these institutions, the government we had, the direction we were in, like none of it is something we should be in favor of. But like that's not enough. Like intuition and being able to kind of point out that like that era of politicking, and even like maybe like religious developments that happened during that time, like they were wrong. But like it's easy for you to like point out something is wrong just on intuition, but if you don't have the actual answer for what is right, then you're just going to be kind of driven by your own sort of like emotions and whims and biases. And I think the issue is that like the MAGA types, insofar as they're religiously motivated, they're not even trying to like harken back to like the Constitution. A lot of them are trying to harken back to say that like, no, liberalism has failed and we need to you know, embrace some sort of like, I don't know, like older form of Christianity and Christian view of politics. And that's not just Trump. That's also people in Trump's orbit. Like Vance has made some comments that are even concerning at times. And then there's obviously Christian nationalists who are encircled, you know, in these, maybe not like close to Trump in power, but like there are these influencers who are trying to influence the MAGA crowd in that direction. You know, I think a couple of years ago, a lot of libertarians were thinking we could influence MAGA in a libertarian direction, and maybe we reached some of them, but many more are now being pushed in this more authoritarian one.
Yeah. You talked about kind of going on emotion, and one thing that stuck out to me in this article is that the authors seem to define the Magisterial Reformation versus the Radical Reformation less by their convictions and more by like their vibes as the authors perceive them. And so they say, quote, "The radical spirit rightly led some American evangelicals to abolitionism when that stance was risky, but the mainline supported slavery because, quote, they prioritized respectability and social order over the revolutionary and liberationist implications of the gospel," end quote. And so, you know, I appreciate myself the admission that the implications of the gospel are Anabaptist rather than Reformed. Uh-huh. But is it really the case that the difference between like an Anabaptist, like a Mennonite and a Presbyterian, is just that the Mennonites are erratic and the Presbyterians are like that town in Footloose that didn't allow dancing? And and then also, you know, like, is that really the difference between like a Bush Republican and like a Trump Republican? And by Bush Republican, of course, I mean Jeb Bush, who is, I think, the best Bush, the Bush that we should be emulating.
I'm not sure if I understood. So what's the question?
I can start. So I'll summarize. Okay, so is the case really between Radical Reformation and Magisterial Reformation one of like sort of vibes, that the radicals were just kind of willing to just go wherever they felt like they needed to go, follow the gospel, who cares? And the mainlines were like, well, you're not wrong necessarily, but you know, we have to be concerned about respectability and blah, 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 blah. We can't be too rebel.
You know, I don't know that it's right to, again, I think couching this in terms of Radical Reformation versus Magisterial Reformation, I think is wrong. Although I can like, I can be like intellectually flexible enough to like kind of grant that like there's like some partial truth to that. Like there's like elements to that where if you hone in on, like you can sort of like cherry pick certain things and kind of like make a general case, but I don't think it holds up. But I do think that we are stuck in this sort of the people who are, again, who the main, like when people are thinking about politics from a Christian perspective, they are kind of like stuck in. So first of all, we should plug ourselves here, which is like, I think we here at LCI are the exception to what I'm about to say, because I think we are trying to be intellectually rigorous and appealing to church tradition and sort of deriving from scripture lessons about government and human relationships and authority, and, you know, push that as far as like discussions regarding how Christians should view the public and political spheres. That being said, as we're still a small but growing force in this, you know, broader conversation, it does seem like the intellectuals in the Christian political space, in terms of what people are not going to get when they just kind of like are generally searching out there, is not people like us. They're going to get people who are arguing for, you know, at best, something like a modified classical liberalism, but that still has a lot of flaws to it. Or, you know, but you know, the average or median is going to be, just kind of like more of this kind of modern faux liberalism that we live under. And the people, and then the other intellectuals are just like, you know, there's people who like, I like their approach that they're trying to be intellectual and like even like scholastic and appealing to, to, you know, like there's a lot of Catholics who are appealing to Aquinas and they're Thomists. There's guys like Jay Dyer on the Eastern Orthodox side who are very well read on you know, like extremely well read on all the church fathers and the Cappadocian fathers, and have like a sort of Eastern sort of schema for sort of like arguing for a sort of Christian view of society and politics. So like, but like other than, so like all roads are leading to kind of something similar, but just from different angles. So like there, you're either stuck in vibes, and vibes are always going to appeal to just kind of like very, very high time preference behavior, very reactionary mindsets. And the people who aren't offering vibes are still just apologists for statism of a different variety. And so it does kind of leave people, I think, stuck in this sort of like, if they have intuition that leads them to be dissatisfied with that, they're more likely to check out of politics unless they encounter Christian libertarianism, in my opinion. Again, not to you know, boast us up too much, but I do think that is kind of the case. Like I'm sure you encounter this too. I encounter a lot of people who are checked out of politics because they're just like, I their instinct is right, because they're just like, I'm not going to fall into the vibes, but I don't really agree with what a lot of the intellectuals are saying. But it's because it's just like they haven't heard our arguments. And then they start hearing, you know, Christian libertarian arguments. And then they're like, oh, no, I actually agree with that. So even if they're not like necessarily going to go read Rothbard or Mises and become a, you know, like a card carrying libertarian, I think that's the problem, though, is that, vibes versus intellectualism, it is sort of like, there's differences, right? Like, I'm not saying there's definitely a difference in sort of like the spirit of MAGA versus the spirit of like Bush era conservatism. And yet on a policy level, like, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, right? Like, we still have immigration controls and war and economic, Keynesianism and interventionism. So it's kind of like, you know, I think we often make this joke that like Donald Trump, you know, talks like this, you know, when he's running, he sounds like Ron Paul, but when he's in office, he governs like Bill Clinton.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the distinction that I've sort of made, there's more to it than this. And maybe even a few things you could say, you know, more positively about Trump compared to like a Bush, but what I've sort of felt like is if the guy is not going to significantly challenge the state apparatus and the way it works, like legitimately the way it works, if he's just going to do it in a different way, then what's really the point? And so like the difference between like a George W. Bush and a Donald Trump is that the people in the room with George W. Bush are smart and the people in the room with Donald Trump are not. And so like, so to me, it's like, you know, well, we're not going to in any way challenge the state and how bad it is and just how dysfunctional and corrupt it is. We're just going to, instead of hiring really smart people, we're just going to hire really dumb people, or really corrupt people, really just kind of people who are just sort of transparently bootlickers and butt kissers and just people who don't, you know, really understand anything about how this stuff works.
I agree. I think there's a silver lining to that, to the extent that it's actually pushing the remnant within the MAGA movement who really were committed to their principles to kind of see that, like, wow, this they're becoming more, you could say, red pilled, and maybe like coming closer to us. And there's people on the left, you know, now who are more open to conversations about you point out all the examples of where Donald Trump is abusing executive power, that Obama or Biden is the ones who kind of set the precedent for that. And sort of like saying like, hey, you know, you don't like all this stuff. You don't like that Trump's acting like a, you know, a dictator. And like, I agree with you. Like, what if we, you know, just imagine for me a scenario where we're not stuck in this predicament, right? And it is weird to see the flip on the Epstein stuff too, where Democrats are now the ones who are somewhat more loudly calling for that. And to some extent, like, I can be maybe a little bit pessimistic and think that it's just like for tribalistic reasons that they are. But I don't know. Like, I feel like there's also an extent to which I think people on right and left who are not completely captured by party politics are, at least, even if they haven't stumbled upon libertarianism yet, like, I hope they're at least like realizing that it is kind of more of the same from both of them, and that there's this like innate evilness and corruption that again, like, I feel there's a lot of people who are very blackpilled right now because like they don't know. They're just like, what's the answer, right? Like, what do we do? Yeah. Like,
you have to destroy the ring, not give it to Gollum. Yeah, and I had hoped that would be the case, that Trump would kind of lay bare, like, who the man is behind the curtain, like what's really going on, and just how bad the system's always been. But I got to tell you, my left-leaning friends, even friends who were kind of more like kind of George W. Bush conservative and family members, who are just, you know, so never Trump, it's made them, I think what they see Trump is so bad that the previous order to them looks better. And so instead of making them sort of go, it's all of it's bad and it's always been bad, they're sort of saying, like, my Democrat grandma, who, you know, always votes Democrat, said, you know, I kind of miss George W. Bush. And I said, the guy who started two fake wars that we were in for, you know, most of our, you know, the last 20 years, you, like, you know, you miss him. And, like, you know, on some level, like, I get it, because, you know, he's not like, you could kind of ignore George W. Bush and go about your daily life for the most part. He didn't, you know, kind of, you know, jump in constantly to, you know, stare the hell out of you and make you worry about the direction the country was going. So, like, that, but that's, I think, I'd hope that we would have a libertarian moment in response to Trump. And I haven't seen it like I hoped. But
we're never going to have a libertarian, well, I mean, I guess never say never. We're probably never going to have a libertarian moment, but on like a macro scale. But that doesn't mean that we don't have, I mean, think about like the Ron Paul movement and revolution. That wasn't like the majority of the country suddenly became libertarian, but it wasn't.
But
it was like,
sizable. Do you think amount, something like yeah. that's happening now? Because I'm not so sure. I'm sure there's a lot I'm of people saying, going back and forth, but.
Well, I think that the ground is fertile for that to happen. I think there are people who are like, if the right people, you know, maybe like us or others, right? You know, Spike Cohen and Dave Smith and. Even author guys like Justin Amash out there and, you know, people at Reason, people at, you know, like if the right people get out there and, you know, make these points to these disenfranchised people, I do think that there is, well, I don't know. I think maybe I'm being a bit optimistic, but I think there is hope for that to happen. I do think that people are. Because, I mean, there's only so many ways you can go. You can either, like, take the blue pill and, like, plug yourself back into the matrix and be like, I don't think, you know, and I agree. There's people who are going to just be like, no matter what, they're always going to compare. They're going to romanticize the past, right? People who think that, like, you know, oh, I didn't like Biden when he was in office. But now that Trump's in, oh, man, Biden would have been better. You know, Harris would have been better or whatever. And it's just like, yeah, that's always going to happen, I think. And some of those people we can try to reach, but we're probably going to have diminishing returns. But I don't know. And I guess this is my own bias and experience, just like, but I just know in my church is pretty even split. Like, people who are more Democrat, center left leaning people, and ones who are more like right wing, center right leaning. But like, even where they disagree, and even when there's like arguments, for like the most part, like 80% of them just kind of seem like, this is all so dumb. Mm-hmm. They're just like, right, you know, right. And now they take it in a direction where I think they kind of then go, where I think the mistake is they go, whatever, politics. And there's like a truth to it, but it's taken too far. We're like, we just need to forget about politics because the kingdoms of this world are not going to save us. And we just need to focus on the gospel and evangelism and doing church things. And I'm like, yeah, like, to a point, but like, you might not care about politics, but politics cares about you. Right. And I do think to some extent, like, there's a Christian obligation to care about the ramifications of what politicians are doing. Right. Like, it's kind of be like, I don't think, like, imagine being a Christian in like America and like reading about the Holocaust and being like, yeah, but like, I don't know, like that's governments, and like, who am I to like sit here and like try to judge what politicians and different nations are doing in their governments? And I'm like, well, maybe that applies for like if you're not a libertarian and you're thinking about like tax policy or something that we would still argue is major, but like it's, I think it's different when we're talking about like the worst atrocities that the state does. And this administration is doing like, is doing some pretty naked, like open aggressions, both domestic and abroad right now. So I don't think that it's like, I don't know what the, like, you know, I'm not like an open borders absolutist, but like, I don't know how a Christian can just be like imagine living in like Texas or one of these states where it's just like, oh, cool. Like ICE just raided the apartment building next to me. Well, that's just, you know, that's politics. Who's to say what's right there?
Yeah. Well, and that's bad enough when they're just kind of, when they're picking up, you know, randomly, you know, immigrants minding their business who maybe are here illegally, but they're working and they're not hurting anybody. But when they're picking up people who are not even illegal and then they just disappear for weeks into the system, some of these are like kids. People can't find their kids, man. And they're like here legally and they're like being shuffled across the country. It's insane.
Conservatives who are 100% against the COVID regime are ushering in like the
Ellen Gonzalez 2.0.
Yeah, like the next time we have a COVID regime,
yeah,
it's going to have way more teeth and way more of a, you know, ability to really make our lives miserable than it did last time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I guess the one benefit of having Donald Trump for the worst part of COVID is that he couldn't make up his mind whether he supported a state of, you know, the status quo approach to COVID or not. He's like, I got the vaccines, but he's also like, you know, maybe drink bleach. But so yeah, all so I think just kind of wrapping up thinking about the article a little bit. I want to think about if there is a framing here that maybe they didn't quite get right, but that could be useful. And so, you know, all comparisons and framing devices break down eventually, but I think they can still be useful if the comparisons are strong enough. And so I don't think this one is, but I'm going to suggest a different framing that I think is useful. And that is that establishment conservatism, the stuff that we kind of lived through before Trump, is the magisterial reformation. And so that's partly what they're saying, but I think that that's correct to an extent. And so, you know, there's this idea that, well, we want to go back to the foundations, but, you know, as Luther did, but it's kind of more interested in maintaining the big government status quo. And, you know, so like on, you know, I mean, this is, so like you, someone like Marco Rubio, for example. So this article is going to quote Marco Rubio and his kind of traditional conservative politics and say, that's like the Protestant Reformation. That's the stuff that's rooted in the gospel. And it's like, you know, Rubio's foreign policy view is regime change everywhere but Israel. And you know, maybe he forgives his enemies, but he also wants them to blow them to bits. And that's gospel forgiveness and love. You know, nah, that's not biblical, but it is magisterial. It is the kind of stuff that Luther might have said. And so I think establishment conservatism is that magisterial reformation, if you're going to do a parallel. And then I think libertarianism is the radical reformation. It's critical of the statist establishment. It wants to build an alternative free society that's not founded on violence, but that's built on voluntary associations and institutions. And, you know, I've talked about that in other places and written books about it. So we'll just leave that there. And then I think what MAGA is doing is they are an element of the radical reformation. And it's a group that were called the Munsterites. These are people who were kind of early Anabaptists who decided that, you know, yeah, sure, the institutions are bad and blah, 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 blah. And they were even sort of paid lip service to pacifism, nonviolence and stuff. But then what they ended up doing is they said, well, but the kingdom of God is coming now. And God wants us to take over the city of Munster. It's going to be the new Jerusalem. And we're going to, you know, do whatever we want. We're going to, you know, so it became a violent takeover of a city to try to bring about this wonderful new age, right? So they claim to be radical. They claim to reject the status quo, but they were just a different kind of violent power, except it was run by, you know, kind of vengeful wackos instead of elites. And so that's my framing. MAGA is not the Anabaptists, the Radical Reformation generally. It's this one small segment of angry wackos who basically want to do what the establishment conservatives wanted to do, the magisterials wanted to do, but just in a dumber way that was just more insane.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, again, like you said, every device failed at some level, and so like I could nitpick that, but I think there's some general truth to it. And yeah, because I think that, I mean, Mac is not all one thing. So that, you know, that's part of the complicated stuff here, but there's definitely a contingent in MAGA that is, I don't know, like they're kind of both what you cited, but then some of them are kind of doing that. Again, like the, some of the Christian nationalists are not saying like, you know, they're almost like saying the problem is that we weren't the elites, right? And so they're just kind of arguing for a return to pre-liberalism, right? You know, like, occurred to me the other day that like post-libertarianism or post-liberalism is just pre-liberalism.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just recycled old ideas. And so
back when we didn't have enough food or medicine, that, just that whole order of things.
Yeah, exactly. So it's frustrating. I think that, I think, you know, I've tried to be sympathetic to the MAGA camp, even to the Christian nationalist camp. But I think when you don't stop and do the actual work of creating a Christian, like a coherent Christian political theory, then you're going to either kind of just do this like vibes, whims based sort of populist thing, or you're going to appeal to bad intellectual ideas. I think that's the main takeaway I got from all of this. And I think that, you know, like at some point, and maybe it's not going to be a libertarian moment, but at some point, my hope is that at least the church, broadly speaking, realizes that it has to do something different than just kind of like this ebb and flowing between the like doing politics based on the, yeah, just like recycling old ideas or just abandoning ideas and just doing power politics based on just kind of like whatever people are angry about at that particular time. It does kind of feel like a sort of cycle that we've been stuck in for a while. And like the American Revolution, you know, like I know like next year is going to be the whatever anniversary of the American Revolution. And listen, there's a lot of problems we can point to in the revolution, in the war, in the Constitution, in America's history. And yet it's an example of a bunch of people who, some of us were Christians, some of us were deists, but who basically just like argued for ideas and to some extent argued for liberalism and grounded that in a Christian ethos, and argued that men ought be free and that government, if it is to exist, ought just exist to protect people's liberty and rights. And so, like, I'm not saying it happens all the time, and it is kind of more the exception than the rule, but it's also, it's just proof that it can happen, that like you can't hit these points in history where, as Ron Paul said, that like nothing can stop an idea whose time has come. And so but I do think that to some extent that's going to start with Christians having to like there's going to be some Christians who are just going to keep playing that game, and we can try to reach them, and that's but maybe we can't. But I think where my focus right now is just finding the ones who are tired of that game and getting them to have better conversations. You know, I think, you know, just to wax a little bit here, like, you know, I was heavily involved in the LP and the Mises Caucus and all this stuff. And I still think there's some room for political action and engagement. And I'm not like a, you know, I don't know, purist on like not voting or anything like that. But I do think that education and changing hearts and minds and conversations is like it's not maybe like the satisfying answer to our flesh. I think in our flesh we want like you know, libertarians take over the government and usher in some kind of like libertarian. But I'm like, no, like the truth is like the way things happen is sort of through you know, it's a slow march through you know, cultural change through changing hearts and minds through education. And that might mean that we have to suffer through, I don't know how much longer, you know, of kind of like bad presidents and bad policies, bad administrations, but we should continue to call those things out and yet realize that as we continue to have these struggles, that like there's going to be people who are going to realize that that's wrong. And if, you know, if we're capitalizing on that to, again, I think insofar as MAGA has that like crossover with the Radical Reformation, it's because at least enough of them had some kind of like partial capture of the truth to realize that the current elites were bad. It's just that you had this kind of cult of Trump come in and suck all that energy in and channel it into something bad. So I feel like libertarians need to, put it this way, a little bit of populism goes a long way. Like, I don't think we should be populists, but I think we should learn the lessons of populism and try to implement them to some extent while trying to argue for not like tearing the whole, like, we don't want to be like communists and be like, you know, what needs to happen is we need to tear everything down and remake man into a new man, right? And we don't want to just kind of keep on pointing to like, you know, we just need to go back to the way things were in 1500s Europe, right? It's like, you know, we can come up with better alternatives than that, I think.
All right. Well, the article is called "Is MAGA Christianity True Christianity?" It was written by Michael Renaud and Paul D. Miller. And I have had Jacob Winograd as my guest today. Thank you for making the time to be here and talking to us. I said it's a little bit different than what we normally do on Libertarian Christian Podcast, but I thought it was an interesting article, despite the fact that it annoyed me on different points. And I thought it was really worth talking about. I think some cool stuff came out of it. So thanks for lending your thoughts and expertise.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jacob.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group. You are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.